Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I actually don't sound like I have a cold for the first time in 3 weeks. Thank you for joining me on the program today. I have in right now Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we're going to talk about fruit. So we hope that you'll call in with your question or comment at 1-800-826-1495. You can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and right there at the top of the page is today's topic, and you can send us your question or comment there, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back.
So I looked in the garden, and every chance I was getting when it wasn't raining, I was going out and weeding, because mm-hmm. the weeds are just, they're growing tremendously fast. But as I was going out, I'm noticing that I've got two apple trees, especially that need to be thinned. Otherwise, next year, I'm not going to have very much at all on those two trees.
Right. And we're getting right into the thinning time. The optimal time for thinning apples is when the fruit's between a third and a half inch in diameter. And that's the bigger apples, the king bloom fruit, that central fruit in the cluster. Once those get to that size, you really need to start thinning. And the longer you wait beyond that point, the more you're going to affect your return bloom. So yes, you're getting to the point where you want to be worried about it, particularly with varieties that tend to be fairly biennial, tend to go on and off cycle.
My Gala doesn't do that as much, but my Honeycrisp does.
Gala's not too bad. Fuji's bad. Honeycrisp is bad. As we were talking earlier, we have an experiment with Honeycrisp that fruited really heavily last year, and we didn't get it thinned early enough. And this year, there's very little bloom. Some trees have no bloom on them whatsoever, and that's the cycle that you get into. And one of the things that I'm a little bit worried about with Fuji, we had a frost at the research farm that wiped out Fuji. Fuji tends to be a little bit prone to that.
It's a little earlier.
I don't know why. It was blooming the same time as the other varieties, but just a little more sensitive. Mm. And we don't have a lot of fruit set, and I'm concerned that next year we're going to have a thinning challenge on our hands, because they're going to come on very, very, very heavily. And so it's that time to get out and get the thinning done. And that's something you can do, that even if the ground's too wet to be dealing with your vegetables or whatever, you want to thin so that you have one fruit per cluster, one fruit per spur, which is the short shoots, but then leave roughly half of the spurs with no fruit on them, so that those will be resting for the next year.
So if I've got four clusters within, say, a 6-inch diameter area, should I just be leaving one of those?
Well, yeah, if you've got spurs that are very close together like that, then you want to thin it down so that you may only have one fruit on every third spur, so that they're spaced out a little bit.
So at least, what would you say, 6 inches
yeah,
apart?
Yeah, 6 inches along the branch is a good rule of thumb. Now that you can... It also, there is some compensation across the tree. So if you've got one branch that's very heavy and several branches that are lighter, you can maybe put them a little closer together on that branch. One thing to look at too, that I've seen as I've been looking at trees around, is depending on the frost pattern that we had and how that affected your flowers. I've talked to people that don't think they have much of a crop load, and then you look in the top of the tree. You know, if you're on a semi-dwarf tree that's a little bit bigger, that and you had frost near the ground, those lower branches might be setting fruit less than the top of the tree. So you want to make sure that
you're... Look all around.
Yeah, look all around and maybe get up and look closely. And another example of that is with peaches. You know, shifting gears and talking about peaches, it's time to thin peaches too. And the earlier you thin, the better fruit size you're going to get, and the higher quality fruit. And peaches were another example where we had frost damage.
I was going to say, I don't have to worry about thinning this year. I don't have any.
Yeah, and that's very much local. But I was looking at some of our peaches, and there's a surprising amount of fruit in the tops of the trees. Mm. And the problem with peaches is they don't display their fruit very well this time of year. So you really have to get up there and kind of, you know, move some leaves and look around to see what's there, because it's deceptive. It's oftentimes they kind of trick you. You think, well, there's not that much fruit there. And then later on, when, you know, the benefits aren't as great from thinning, you realize, wow, there's a lot more fruit there than I thought. I've got to go back and thin them some more.
Do you have to thin plums?
It depends on the variety of plum.
Like a Japanese plum.
Yeah, and there's some benefit to that. I don't know that a lot of people bother with it. It's not going to affect your return bloom like it will with apples, but it is going to affect your fruit size to some degree.
Well, we've got our first caller. We have Larry in Cedar City. Hi, Larry. How can we help?
Hey, good morning, Brian. Oh, we're beautiful down here in Cedar City, and he's so right about those peach trees. You do. You got to look around and make sure you see something. Some of them look bare just about. Anyway, my question, and it's not necessarily on fruit, but it's a Lafleur fruit, and that we're, in the last 20 years, we've had an infestation of the Russian thistle. It's the thing that will stick you, poke you. I don't think there's a part on that plant that won't hurt you. It grows like weeds. I've tried everything, even Roundup, to try to get rid of it. And I was wondering if either of you two had any magical answers or anything to get rid of that Russian thistle.
It's a problem. That your systemic herbicides are usually your best approach. Not sure that Roundup is the strongest. The factor that you have to keep in mind with specific to fruit crops is you've got to be really careful in when you're using any kind of systemic, whether it's Roundup or any others, around fruit trees.
Yeah.
Well, and the problem that I've seen a lot of with systemic herbicides used around fruit crops is people think that they're safe to spray at the base of the plant, and if there's any root suckers that are present, or if you've got a younger plant where the bark isn't as thick, you can get translocation of systemics across, and you can cause a lot of damage.
Exactly, and it'll do you in. Yeah.
So there's one recommendation that I would look at. The Pacific Northwest, which is a consortium of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, put together a herbicide guide. I believe it's called the Pacific Northwest Weed Guide, or PNW Weed Guide. It's online, and you can search by the crop, whether it's grapes or whether it's apples or strawberries, and then it will list herbicides that are safe to use in those crops, and under that list you can see which weeds those are effective against. And so that's a great resource to look at.
Okay, I'll look that up. Yeah, they've just, in the last 20 years, we used to have a lot of property in a sheep ranch up on the mountain, and that just took in one real beautiful little place that just we call Lily Flat, and pretty soon we were calling it Russian Thistle.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll get online and look at that, and I'll just keep the fight down here. Hey, I appreciate the show, and I appreciate you helping me out. Thank you.
Good luck, Larry. All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
That's a real problem. I mean, it's one thing if you've got a few in your yard. I mean, I just take a shovel and dig them up.
Yeah.
But if you've got a whole field full of those things, I mean, they're massive.
Yeah, and they can be bad from, I mean, part of what he mentioned there at the end with grazing, sometimes if you get them into a pasture situation, then the animals will leave them alone and they kind of have free rein. And so there's some good information on that weed guide. And pastures is one of the categories that you can look at what's available and what's good to use. And I would suggest that he contact his local county office because they have quite a bit of experience with grazed situations and weed management in those situations.
Would it help if, I know you took several people out to this field in the fall, say September, and notched around each one of these thistles or cut them off and put on something that has like triple whatever. I mean, it could have carfentrazone and like Trimec or something,
right.
And paint it onto the stump. That way, you're not spraying it and it's going right in.
There's some selective herbicides that you can use for broadleaves, and some of them are quite potent that might work well for that kind of thing where you do more of a spot spray. I mean, spraying it on the leaves can be very effective. And if it's a broad spectrum mix like you're talking about, if you go out with a backpack sprayer and you're just hitting the plants individually, that can be quite effective as well.
I was just thinking like bindweed. I don't even try to control it other than pull it until the fall. But then in the fall, that's when I do use the Roundup or the glyphosate because then it pulls it down into the roots and
that,
takes care of it.
In that case, you can tell when it's fairly established and it's starting to bloom and late in the season is a really good time because you can get a good kill. But at the same token, one of the recommendations for using broad spectrum directed spray applications in fruit crops like with raspberries. So if you've got bindweed or you've got thistle or whatever that you're trying to control, they recommend that you don't treat around raspberries after midsummer, because the raspberries are doing the same thing as the bindweed. They're translocating resources back to the roots. And if you get a little bit of incidental exposure late in the summer, you're going to have a lot more damage to the raspberries. And that's true of a lot of the perennials. You've got to be super, super careful late in the season, because any little bit of exposure on the bark, on a root sucker, is going to cause a lot more damage that time of year than if you're doing it earlier in the year.
But you could do a broadleaf in the raspberries earlier in the year?
As a directed spray. So in other words, you're shielding it from the raspberries. You're just hitting
the weeds. That's kind of hard.
It's tricky. But that's really, you know, and that's one of the commercial approaches. If you go on that weed guide publication that I mentioned earlier, it'll say directed spray at this time of year is okay.
Okay.
And that's when, you know, if you get a little bit of incidental drift or whatever on the plants, it's not as damaging as if you do it at other times of the year.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is in studio with me. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist. We'd love to take your question or comment. Go to our Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and you'll see at the top of the page today's topic, and you can just post your question or comment there. You can send it to via email, zestygarden@gmail.com, or call us toll-free 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So I want to back up. I have a couple more questions on fruit thinning. So what makes one variety more susceptible to every other year type bearing than another? Is it just genetics?
Yeah, it's partly genetics. Part of it is so what causes that is when the fruit is pollinated, when the flower's pollinated and starts to develop, the seeds start to develop. And the seeds signal the tree, signal the plant that they're developing and that resources need to be sent to support the development of that fruit. But that same signal that's signaling the plant to maintain that fruit so the seeds can develop properly also inhibits initiation of a flower for the next year. So really the time window over the next several weeks here, at least in northern Utah, is when in the case of apples, the plant is deciding whether or not that spur is going to produce a flower for next year. It's already happening for next year right now. And that's why, this is a critical thinning time, because you've got to remove that signal so that the flowers develop for next year. And some varieties tend to produce more seeds in the fruit, have a stronger signal, or more susceptible to that signal in terms of limiting the flower initiation. They tend to be more prolific in flowering to begin with, so that they tend to synchronize themselves better. And then when we have frost like we've had this year, you know, everybody that didn't get fruit this year are going to be set up to have every single spur on that in that apple flowering next year.
I know Jonna Gold was I don't have it anymore. I took it out, but it was terrible about every other year. Strong, even when I thinned it earlier, it still wanted to go every other year.
Some of them are just more have a higher propensity for that.
Does it also is it influenced by the rootstock?
To some extent, not as much as you might think. The rootstock has influence on how early in the cycle the tree starts to flower and fruit. So younger trees that flower and fruit heavily, that's influenced by rootstock. I don't think that they have a big impact on biennality, like just the scion variety does.
I noticed in my garden when we did get the frost earlier in the year. Interestingly enough, most of my apples that are still left on the tree are the king blossom apples. Mm-hmm. It's the flowers to the side that got frosted, but the king blossom didn't.
So some years that's the case. Some years we've seen, in fact, in some orchards in Utah County, we've seen this year it was just the opposite, that the king flowers came out, bloomed, were pollinated, and started to develop, and the laterals came out, and there was a late frost, and it was cold enough to damage the unpollinated flowers, but not the developing fruitlets. So you see both cases. You'll have where you'll have a depending on when the frost came, you can have the king, almost all king fruits, or you can have no king fruits and all lateral fruits. It just it's really depends on the timing of that frost.
Well, and having all king fruits, I'm okay with that.
Thing. That's a good
thing. I'm
going
to have big apples. And,
yeah.
Although I got hail last week,
yeah.
and literally it was within like a 4-block area, because just 4 blocks south of me, it would just rain. They didn't get any hail. And so as I looked at the tree, I've got little marks on the apples. I'm sure the ones further in are more protected, but the ones on the outside.
And depending on when that happens, usually the earlier in the year you get the hail pock marks, the more chance that it's going to heal and not look too bad. But and closer you get to harvest, the worse those end up looking for some strange
reason. And I'll eat most of them myself, so I'm not too worried.
And they make just as good applesauce as anything else. But and that's another point to make, is when you go out to do thinning, you want to make sure that you look around and see if there's any hail damage or any other kinds of problems, maybe russeting from the frost. We'll get what they call frost rings or fairy rings sometimes on the young fruit when we get a frost after it's pollinated. So you can, as you're hand thinning, you want to be aware of that and keep the, selectively remove those damaged fruits, so that even if it is the king fruit that are damaged, if you've got laterals there that are in better shape, you're going to be better off down the road to keep those.
So how important is it to, you were mentioning earlier, maybe you've got a little bit heavier apple set further up, but a lot less on another side. Are you looking at the tree as a whole as far as the number of leaves to feed that one apple, or is it more closely related to the leaves around that apple?
The majority of what feeds the apple are the leaves on the spur and immediately adjacent spurs, but that's not 100% the case. So if you have, there is some compensation. So if you've got parts of the tree that are fairly heavy, in terms of fruit size, it will compensate. In terms of the return bloom, it's very localized.
Okay, well, I'll keep that in mind while I'm thinning this weekend, because it looks like it's finally going to be warmer weather and sunshine and
a lack of rain for a change.
My garden because I had leaves on from last year, and unfortunately those leaves are keeping the moisture in, but I'm really looking forward to having a good weekend.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first thing that I wanted to ask about berries, because I mentioned this in the promo, I don't want to forget about it. Why is it that you can grow raspberries here, but you can't grow marionberries, or you can't grow, I don't know about lagenberries and
Logan,
the different or loganberries?
So the marionberry, loganberry, boysenberry, most of those are raspberry blackberry hybrids, and unfortunately, the blackberry parent, there's different species of blackberry, and we categorize them by their growth habits. So the semi-erect type blackberries are the most cold hardy, and the semi-erect and then the erect, and the trailing types are the least hardy. And so as it turns out, the parent blackberry for all those really nifty hybrids are the trailing types. And so what we've tried to grow them in our research plots, and they grow really well, but they freeze to the ground every year, and they're all summer bears.
Kill the plant.
No,
just
it just takes off all the fruiting wood every year. So yeah, and so we had a plot at Kaysville with a number of these, and 1 out of 5 years we got fruit, and so that's the challenge, is because they're all floricane fruiting, and the floricanes kill back to the ground level or the snow line, depending on what your conditions are when you get that freeze, you just don't get any fruit on those. They grow a big, bushy, beautiful plant, and then they die back to the ground, and then they go again the next year.
So when you say you got fruit 1 every 5 years, did you have to bury those floricanes?
We just had a real mild. We've tried different things. We've tried laying the canes down on the ground, and tried laying the canes down on the ground and cover them up with row covers and different things. And that can help in certain circumstances, but we found it to be not a huge advantage in our environment. I know in areas where they get a lot of wet, heavy snow, where they lay the canes down and get snow cover on the canes, then you can get some improved survival that way. Our situation, it never really helped. And it was, and when we went back and looked at the weather data, it probably was because the damage was occurring in November or in February or March, not in the middle of the winter. Because the years that we'd have really bad cane damage, it didn't get any colder in January than the years when we didn't have a lot of cane damage. But the years where we saw a lot of cane damage, it was because we had a cold snap.
That transition.
Thanksgiving week or, you know, the plants hadn't acclimated very well and then it got very cold. And then the other thing that causes damage in raspberries and blackberries is desiccating winds in the winter, which we tend to get those as well. So the laying them down and trying to cover them with a row cover didn't have a huge benefit.
What about further south?
So I think there's areas in the south where that you could do it better. You'd have a better chance, just depending on your conditions.
It's like maybe in Moab?
Yeah, potentially. So there's
Green River.
Yeah, well, Green River, the wind factor comes into play again. But yeah, some of the milder climates, it's possible that those would work a little bit better. And part of it is, you know, with a home garden situation, if you've got an area that's protected, then from the winds and that you could cover, then you'd have a lot better chance than trying to do it out in fields or out in an more open area in your garden.
So in areas like St. George that just are really hot during the summer, you have a hard time growing things like apples. Mm-hmm. Can you grow peaches?
Yes, the peaches do really well. And some of the peaches were selected for the Central Valley of California, so they like that midsummer heat. They're low chill, so they and they'll do very well down in there on that area.
So how does the heat then affect an apple? Do they just not get enough cold hours during the winter?
No, you can get some lower chill apples, but the fruit development can be a problematic when it's really hot. So you'll get the fruit doesn't ripen very well. The tree has a hard time transpiring fast enough to cool itself. They're just not a real heat tolerant plant. And that's true of some of the brambles as well. Raspberries don't like a lot of heat like that. And so they don't do really well under those circumstances.
So what would you recommend for the lower elevation areas of Washington County?
Well, I think peaches are a good option. I mean, I think there's things that they can grow that we can't grow up here.
Pomegranate.
Right, exactly.
Almonds.
Yeah. So there's some of those kinds of things that do quite well. A number of the stone fruits do pretty well under hot conditions. Plums and pluots and things like that would do fairly well under their conditions. And you know, Washington County is a big area. There's areas that are cooler than say St. George itself.
I mean, if you go to Brookside and further up Central, that area, they're higher elevation.
Right. Some things that do, yeah, and apples do very well in some of those situations. New Harmony and areas up there that are cooler, kind of in the mountains, do really well.
Okay. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. We get him for about 10 more minutes. 800-826-1495. You can go online to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Right at the top is today's topic, and you can post your question or comment there. Or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So with the wet weather, what are you seeing happening? Because I was thinking this year was going to be great. I'm not going to see much iron chlorosis.
Yeah.
Well, then May
we're
hit.
Seeing lots
and
of
I've
iron
had
chlorosis.
Almost 2.5 straight weeks of moisture in my garden every single morning.
So I was looking at the weather station here on campus, and we had 21 out of the last 27 days we've had measurable precipitation.
The airport broke a record because I was looking at the Utah Climate Center, and it was already over the record set in like 87 or something. So
the couple of things that I have been seeing in orchards and in home garden situations as well, heavier soils, you're going to have iron chlorosis. And some of that is, I've seen kind of 2 degrees of that. I've seen some very mild iron chlorosis where people have been trying to manage that and putting out chelates and so forth. And it's just a matter of soil being cold and really not very much photosynthesis. It's been overcast. It's been cool. So soil temperature's cold, air temperature's cold. Plants just aren't moving in terms of nutrient uptake. So, and that's really more common on heavy soils. I have seen situations that mimic nitrogen deficiency, the light green colored leaves that are across the whole leaf, not just the interveinal areas, and then sometimes a little bit of a pink or reddish tinge to the trees. And that, I'm not recommending that people go out and start putting more nitrogen on, but on lighter soils, some of what was put there in terms of fertilizer has been leached. You know, we're talking, at least in the northern part of the state, we've had 5.5 inches of rain in the last 3 weeks. That's a lot of rain. And so nitrogen is, you know, if we put it on as organic matter, it's mineralized and is released as nitrate and ammonium, and those are very mobile in the soil. So once you start pushing a lot of water through that soil, especially if it's well-drained, lighter soil, a lot of that just moves out faster than the tree can take up what it needs. I don't think that means we need to run out and start putting on more nitrogen just yet. If we can get some warm, sunny weather and that rate of leaching slows down, I think there's going to be a chance for plants, for trees to recover. Well, the iron on the, if it's mild, again, if we get some warm, sunny conditions, they'll probably recover. But I'm also seeing situations where it's fairly severe and you've got to start getting aggressive to catch up on it. And that's going to mean probably some soil drenches, as well as in some of the more severe cases, foliar application of iron chelates.
And it's got to be the right chelate. I mean,
it does.
So what do you know?
So the best one for soil applications is the EDDHA. That's what they call red iron, because it's in solution. It looks kind of rusty red. And So
that's good for 7, alkalinity of 7 and above?
7 and above. That's okay. The only one that works in a really alkaline soil. The fertilizer stores call it red iron, but there's several different names for it. A lot of them have a 1,3,8 in the name. Then there's another one, and the name of the chelate's not coming to me right now, but it's not as good as a soil drench at the really high pHs, but it works very well as a foliar application. And if you've got fruit trees that you don't want red stains on the peels of the fruit, then it's called yellow iron, and it's a different chelate, and it doesn't stain the fruit. And
so it's not good for the soil, but you could, if you've got a severe case of iron chlorosis, you could put it on the leaves, and that'll take it in a lot quicker than the soil.
So what happens with, if you put the foliar iron on, the leaves that get treated turn green, but new emerging leaves are still going to be yellow because there's no supply in the vascular tissue or in the roots. So if you've got a real severe situation, we recommend both putting the foliar on to green up the leaves that are there, and then getting the soil drench on the roots so that new growth that comes out later in the season will not be deficient.
And I don't think we can stress this enough. It's very important to look at the package, because it should tell you this is good for a pH in the soil of between this and this. And the red ones I have seen, it's a 7 and above.
And above.
So most of our soils are 7 and above.
And the yellow version, it starts to lose its efficacy once you get above 7, 7.5. It really drops off in terms of its chelating efficiency. But on the leaf and in the leaf, that's really in the right range, and it works fine.
And I'll warn you, it's not cheap.
It's not cheap.
You don't have to use a ton, but it's not cheap.
But when you see how effective it is, it's worth it.
Okay, real quickly, in the last minute, someone who called and didn't want to stay on the air, wanted to know about pruning Bing cherries. It's a bit late for pruning,
It's late for pruning cherries, yeah. So sweet cherries tend to be very upright. So pruning is part of what you're doing is you're well, there's a couple principles, and we're running out of time, but one of which is you want to you thin by pruning. So you go in and you look where all the flower buds are, and usually you cut back. That's usually at the base of 1 year wood and into the second year wood. Cutting about half of that off will improve your crop load quite a bit. Other general pruning principles apply as well. Keeping the tree open, you want to select for more horizontal branches, which in Bing is really hard because they all want to go upright. So you may want to be bending branches and selecting for the outer branches.
And usually February, early March?
Yeah, that's one of the last ones you do during the dormant period because they tend to be cold sensitive. So just, yeah, depending on where you are in the state, starting in late February into March is really the best time.
Okay, Brent, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is the USU Extension Fruit Specialist and has been with us every month. And real quickly, in our gardening calendar, Wasatch Community Gardens in Salt Lake is holding a permaculture principles workshop this Saturday from 10 to 2. Details are at wasatchgardens.org. And the Stokes Nature Center in Logan Canyon is hosting backyard harvest, veggie harvest and storage, Saturday, June 6th from 10 to 11:30. Information is at logannature.org. And then the Logan Iris Society is having their flower show tomorrow from 1 until 7 and Saturday from 9 until 4 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church in Logan. Coming up next, we're going to have a pumpkin discussion. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I'm talking with Lindsay Bench, who is the media contact with the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers. And Lindsay, we had a conversation earlier in April about how to grow a giant pumpkin, and I wanted to check in with you each month and see where things are. Now, the weather's been a bit weird, rainy and cold. How has that affected your pumpkin growing?
The weather has been not so great for the pumpkin growing. It's better to have the sun, obviously. The leaves need the sun for the photosynthesis, and, you know, it's been a little bit cold. So here we're hoping for the warmer weather and the sun to get these vines growing and shooting out, but we've had to keep our plants in our greenhouses longer. We've had to keep the heat on them longer. Some of us have them on thermostats, so we've got little space heaters in there, and we've got our heating cables in the ground. So we've just had to keep them, you know, warmer longer.
So is this a greenhouse that you all share together, or is this your own personal one?
Our own personal greenhouses. Well, we have some in the group that have actually a full-size greenhouse, but we also have just our own makeshift greenhouses. We've got PVC pipes bended into our own hoop house type structures. I got mine from Sam's Club. It's just a little, it's a greenhouse that's already made. It's small. It's like an 8x10 or a 6x8.
It's keeping it protected somewhat from the elements. So I'm assuming if you got hail like I did last week, that's not going to bother your pumpkin, at least at this point.
Right. Yeah. You know, some of us got some really bad hail. People have been posting pictures on Facebook that some of their structures, either structures got caved in and ruined because of the hail. So good thing for some of those structures because the plants will be torn to shreds.
How large is your plant right now? How long is the longest runner?
Oh, you know what? I was going to measure that. It's probably about 6 feet.
6 feet already?
Yeah. Crazy, huh? I had my two plants in, but I had to cut one off, and I'm down to one. It's about 5 or 6 feet.
You had two vines or you had two plants?
I had two plants. I've got about 750 square feet, and that's only room for one.
Oh, so that's why you had to cut one of them out. You don't want them to compete with each other, so you just took the one that was looking better than the other?
Right. I start the two in case there's all these different things that can happen. I feel like the more I know, the more it happens. You know, all the bad can happen. The diseases or ribbon vine or bugs can get to them. So, yeah, just whatever one looks better, or if one happens to get ribbon vine, then you have your backup plan.
So what else have you had to deal with in the last 5 or so weeks?
You know, I got some insecticidal soap. So my personal problem with that was that I soaked it down with insecticidal soap, thinking that I had mites already because I'm paranoid. We talked about that a little bit last time because I've had mites in the past. And I burned my plant, the new transplant. And I thought I was doing it good. And a few days later, it looked like it had mosaic virus. So I thought I'd lost the plant. I thought my season was over, but it ended up just being, it looked just like it, but it ended up just being burnt.
So it kept growing, though, obviously.
Yes, it grew out of it. I've had to add some magnesium. I had some yellowing on the leaf between the margins. So that greened it up. One of my plants, the one I ended up cutting off, was just really strong, growing straight in the air instead of vining down. And I came home one day and it flopped right over and bent in half. My heating cable's too hot, and so my leaves had some, were showing some heat, you know, some heat damage. Hmm. So it's just funny, some of the things, you know, that you just, seems like, it almost seems like so much can go wrong. And the first time I grew, it was like, how did it happen so right when I didn't know anything?
And how many times have you grown? Is this your second year?
Three. This is my third.
Third
this
year.
This is my third
okay.
year.
When do you start seeing blossoms come onto the plant? Is it usually the male blossoms come on first?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I actually have some male blossoms. They're not blossoming, but I've got some little flowers on there, and I've actually had, I have some females on there. I've taken off some of the females. I guess for those people that don't grow pumpkins, the females have a little ball at the bottom of the blossom. I've clipped off some of the females on the secondary vines. The ones that are on the main vine are the ones that we want to grow and typically keep because they get all that, you know, the main juice from the plant.
Do you ever clip any of the vines completely out, or do you just clip off the female blossoms so that the energy all from those vines goes into the one or two pumpkins that you might keep?
You want to keep the secondary vines, and then we cut off any of the tertiary vines because they typically just suck the juice from the plant and
so
just take the energy.
What does a tertiary vine look like?
It looks the same. It just, so you have the main vine that comes off of the stump, mm-hmm. you know, right where you grow the plant. And then the secondary vines grow off of that main vine.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And then a tertiary vine would be any vine that grows off those secondaries.
Ah, gotcha. So you've got the one main vine coming from the pumpkin where mm-hmm. it's in the ground. And if you had anything else coming out at that point, you would just take them off. You take the side vines off of that main vine. You keep those. But anything coming off those side vines, you take those off. You don't want those growing.
Yeah, uh-huh, correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And there are different patterns that people like to follow. One of the most popular is a Christmas tree. So if you had just a rope and thought of that as your main vine, and you spread the rope down, and then you had crosses coming off the rope that were perpendicular as your secondaries and grew those out perpendicular, that's kind of like a pattern that someone would grow their plants in. And then, like you said, anything coming off those secondary vines would be clipped.
At what point do you then open your pumpkin up to the elements, or do you ever do that, or just keep it in the greenhouse?
It's kind of personal preference, but as long as you can keep the plant covered, the better. I'm probably going to take, mine's outgrowing the greenhouse, so, you know, we cover them with shade. At this point, it's kind of getting to where most of us will have to take it out of the greenhouse, but we'll set up some kind of structure for shade as it gets warmer because the direct sunlight will burn the leaves. It's kind of like putting up shade, making sure that the sun isn't directly on the leaf, and also, you know, when we get to that point, the pumpkin itself, we don't ever expose to the sunlight.
Because you don't want to scald
it. Under full shade or a blanket or sheet, I guess.
So how do you move the pumpkin out from the, I mean, is it growing in a really big pot and then you move it out, or do you just take the walls down?
Oh, there's so much to talk about. You don't want to grow it right on the dirt. You put sand under it. There's so many different techniques you can use, but as far as moving it, you know, sometimes it takes taking a big tractor or a big lift. Last year, mine wasn't huge, but it took, you know, four people lifting it under a, what are they called, a lift pallet. But some of these guys that are, you know, their pumpkins are huge. It takes, you know, you have to have some kind of lifting machine to lift them out of their backyards or and into, you know, take them to Thanksgiving Point at the layoff. But
you're not actually moving the whole plant, though, just the pumpkin itself?
Right, just the pumpkin. You cut it off at that point, you know, for the end of the season. But
okay, so the pumpkin.
But yeah, no, you leave the pumpkin in the patch the whole
okay.
time. And you, some people ask if you rotate them, but no, you just keep them there. Sometimes you want to avoid moving them, but sometimes you kind of have to get kinks out of the vine. But for the most part, you just want to keep them still so you don't happen to break the vines or anything like that.
Do you let the pumpkins remain if they're growing on their side versus setting them up so that the stem is on the top? What's the preference there?
Yeah, on the side. On the side, you don't, the blossom end at the bottom, if it gets wet or stays wet, it'll get blossom end rot. And so if it's on the bottom, it won't dry out and you can't watch for that.
Okay.
There have been people that it grows on the bottom, but you want it on the side so you can watch it and keep it dry.
So what's up next? What's the next stage growth for you in the next couple of weeks?
Right now it's getting the lettuce growing, getting the green, as much plant as you can so that when it's time to fruit set, you have all that green plant to feed that pumpkin. Getting that plant as big as you can, getting it healthy, getting those roots, you know, feeding a lot of phosphorus and trying to get those roots big and the plant big and healthy so that it can feed the pumpkin.
Any secrets? Like any secret ingredients that you add to your pumpkin? I mean, you don't have to divulge them necessarily, but are you doing something special that other growers don't do that will get your pumpkin bigger?
This year, a lot of people are kind of experimenting with CO2.
What, just blowing some over the plant? How would you do that?
Yeast in the dirt. I've heard people doing that or input in the air. I know I work at the Utah County Jail, and some of the inmates were giving me tips. Some of the inmates grow special plants. And they were giving me tips what they do to grow their plants on the outside. And they had used CO2, and they said they use dry ice. Of course, that would take tons and tons of dry ice for a huge pumpkin plant, so that wouldn't necessarily work. But there are a lot of products out there, and everyone's kind of scouring the internet and trying to find, you know, a CO2 product. That's kind of like the buzz right now. But
you're a diehard.
Oh, it's fun. It's funny, and it's so fun to get into. And the people are just, I think I told you this last time, but it used to be a joke to me because the whole growing giant vegetable thing was so interesting and silly. But once you get to know these people, you fall in love with them, and it's just so fun.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I've been talking with Lindsay Bench. She's the media contact for Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers, and we'll talk to her each month. Lindsay, thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks so much.
Hi, this is Nancy Williams, here for Petals and Prose this morning. I have been reading to you from Terry Tempest Williams' wonderful book called Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. And she's talking in it about how in the spring of 1983, the Great Salt Lake rose to record heights and began a process of devastation that would eventually destroy the fragile wetlands in northern Utah. And that same spring of 1983, Terry Tempest Williams's mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. This is a memoir that talks about both of these devastating events. I'm reading to you today from her chapter called Killdeer, at which point the lake level had risen to 4,208 feet. She writes, Mimi and Mother and I had our astrology done. It seemed like a reasonable thing to do. As Mimi said, if it sheds light on all the confusion, why not? Mimi is Terry's grandmother. We decided to have a picnic by Great Salt Lake to discuss our charts. We sat on its edge where large boulders had been brought in to secure the shore. Each of us found our own niche in the sun. Three women, a Leo, a Pisces, a Virgo, a grandmother, mother, and daughter. It was beautiful, and it was hot. We saw 6 ruddy ducks, 1 pair of redheads, avocets, stilts, flocks of Franklin gulls, young shrikes on greasewood, and meadowlarks. Mimi and I engaged in our birding ritual: locate, focus, observe, and identify. After the bird flies, we pore over the field guide and debate over which species we have just seen. Mother was amused, saying she wished she liked birds as much as we did, but she had never recovered from Alfred Hitchcock's film, The Birds, and she could see herself all too well as Tippi Hedren fleeing from the wrath of gulls, regardless of whether they were ring-billed or California. "So, what do you believe?" Mother asked. "I believe every woman should own at least 1 pair of red shoes," I answered. Mother grinned. "I'm being serious." "So am I." "When I was a young woman with 4 children, I was always living ahead of myself," she said. "Everything I was doing was projected toward the future, and I was so busy, 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 preparing for tomorrow, for the next week, for the next month, and then one day it all changed. At 38 years old, I found I had breast cancer. I can remember asking my doctor what I should plan for in my future. He said, 'Diane, my advice to you is to live each day as richly as you can.' As I lay in my bed after he left, I thought, will I be alive next year to take my son to first grade? Will I see my grandchildren marry? Will I know the joy of holding my grandchildren?" She looked out over the water, barefoot, her legs outstretched. A white visor held down her short black hair. For the first time in my life, I started to be fully present in the day I was living. I was alive. My goals were no longer long-range plans. They were daily goals, much more meaningful to me, because at the end of each day I could evaluate what I had done. A flock of sandpipers wheeled in front of us. "I believe that when we are fully present, we not only live well, we live well for others." Mimi questioned her, "Why is it then, Diane, that we are so willing to give up our own authority?" "It's easier," I interjected. "We don't have to think. The responsibility belongs to someone else. Why are we so afraid of being selfish? And why do we distract and excuse ourselves from our own creativity?" "Same reason," Mother replied. "It's easier. We haven't figured out that time for ourselves is ultimately time for our families. You can't be constantly giving without depleting the source. Somehow, somewhere, we must replenish ourselves." "But that's antithetical to the culture we belong to," Mimi said. "We are taught to sacrifice, support, and endure. There are other virtues I'm more interested in cultivating," she said, smiling. "I have a joke," I said. "How does a man honor a woman?" "I don't know," Mother answered. "He puts her on a pedestal and then asks her to get down on it." Mimi laughed. Mother tried not to. "That's terrible, Terry." "Oh, Mother, loosen up. There's nobody spying on us unless these rocks are bugged." I picked one up and looked underneath. "We haven't touched our astrology charts," Mimi said, pulling hers out. Mother and I find ours. We read each other's. We had already listened to the individual taped sessions. "I liked the part about Terry being neat and meticulous," teased Mother. "I remember standing in the middle of your bedroom when you were about 13 years old. Everything in your closet was on the floor. Art and school papers were piled high up on your desk. I remember thinking, I have 2 choices here. I can harp on her every day of her life, making certain her room is straight, or I can close the door and preserve our relationship." "Thank you for choosing the latter," I said. "Brooke may feel otherwise." "The thing that struck me about your chart, Diane," said Mimi, "was the tension in your life between your need for privacy and the obligation you feel toward your family." "And I think I've paid a price physically," Mother said. She looked out over the lake and then back to me. "Did anything surprise you about your chart, Terry?" "I think the part that helped me the most was recognizing that I operate with 3 minds. Remember when she said I can look at a teacup and say, 'Isn't this lovely? Notice the pink roses on the white bone china.' Or, 'Isn't this fascinating? Consider the cup in human history.' Or, 'Look at this teacup, the coffee stains and the chip on its rim.' What about you, Mimi?" I asked. "At 79, what did I learn?" she said. "It was more an affirmation of what I already know. I'm aware of my intense curiosity. my compulsion to understand the world around me. I value intelligence. I listened hard to those traits I have to watch. I realize I am a very frank, strong personality as a Leo, but I hope I can evolve to be a Leo with wisdom. I believe we must do things in our lives for the right reasons, because we enjoy doing them, with no expectation of getting something back in return. Otherwise, we are constantly being disappointed. She moved her turquoise bracelet back and forth on her wrist. So I had two sons, John and Richard, because I wanted to, not because I thought they would rescue me in old age. I got out of all social organizations and clubs in my 50s so that I could spend time with my grandchildren, not because they would give something back to Jack and me later on, but because that was what I wanted to do, and I have loved doing it. Believe me, these have been selfish decisions. Silence followed. Mimi looked at me. And you, Terry? I believe in facing life directly, to not be afraid of risking oneself for fear of losing too much. I paused. Here was my mother standing outside the shadow of cancer, and my grandmother standing inside the threshold of old age. These were the women who had seen me through birth. These were the women I would see through death. The three of us stared out at the lake, the color of Chinese porcelain, and were hypnotized by the waves. How do you find refuge in change? I asked quietly. Mimi put her broad hand on mine. I don't know, she whispered. You just go with it. A killdeer landed a few feet from where we were sitting. Killdeer, killdeer, killdeer. What bird is that? Mother asked. A killdeer, Mimi answered, picking up her binoculars. I stood to get a better look. All at once it began to feign a broken wing, dragging it around the sand in a circle. Is it hurt? Mother asked. No, I said. We must be close to its nest. She's trying to distract us. It's a protective device. We're not so different, Mimi said, her silver hair shining in the sun. Shall we go? As we got up to leave, Mother turned to me. I'm so glad you wore your red shoes. Thanks for being with me today. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose in the Zesty Garden. See you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.